were the adherence to the therapy, and what is comparable, what are some things that really MDT and DBT do the same in their sessions, even if for different reasons. So those have been what's been going on in the sessions. We have most of our experts. If any of our lingering experts come in, please come up and join. As they're discussing, what you're going to see is I hope that all of our experts' heads are kind of buzzing with their experience of the day, and the question's going to be, what did you make of it? What are your preliminary conclusions? They're all going to be co-authoring chapters representing the different sessions they were involved with. So hopefully they're trying to sort that out and trying to understand, well, what can I say about how these treatments are compatible, comparable, distinct? So we're going to open it up to the experts themselves to start offering some very preliminary feedback. I'm wondering, actually, for the sake of the audience, maintain their orientation to kind of who's representing what, I'm wondering if we can again do what we did in some of our sessions of have the MBT on one side, DBT on the other. I think I see... could I have the DBT folk maybe take stage right and maybe the MBT? Can we do a dance off? I'll play the music. We can all get up and go around. But just so that when people speak, because not everyone got to see people from every session, so that they can readily see, okay, this is somebody who's representing DBT or this is someone representing MBT. And what I'd like to do is I'd like to invite all of the experts. Yeah, please. Yeah, we may get to integration one day, but we're just not there yet, you know? So I think we should keep this going. So what I'd like to do is... Disintegrate? Oh, the mics, please turn the mics on. They'll have to just be... There we go.
Are we disintegrated?
We might be. So what I'd like to suggest is specifically to invite the DBT... experts and the MBT experts other than Anthony and Alan to begin the discussion about what they learned today about where these lines are. And then certainly Anthony and Alan are welcome to join the conversation. I definitely want to allow them to have some of the kind of the preliminary conclusions of what we learned from today. Again, as you're coming in sitting down, please keep your green card, these index cards handy, because we'd love to have your questions and your observations enter the discussion. So if you have a conclusion and you think, I think this is the way it is, feel free to write that down and get a response, or if there's a question that you would like to pose to the group that wasn't fully addressed, please feel free to send those in, and that'd be wonderful. So putting it to our experts, would anyone care to start us off by sharing something about this basic question, perhaps something you learned about where these lines might be, something that maybe you weren't fully aware of? I see Lois has, I thought I was seeing a little. I saw the hand. I misunderstood the hand. It looks...
I will. So
it's a what did you learn?
Okay.
And there's this kind of overarching theme of to what extent are the therapies the same? To what extent are they compatible that you can incorporate things from one to the other without veering from the model? And what are things that you really noticed that were different? That these are things that do not fit across. But if you'd like to start with a general, what's something you learned today? And just kind of reflect a little bit on what did you learn in the process of doing this? That might be a fine place to start.
Mm-hmm. I mean, I could say, I wish I could integrate all that, but I could say that I learned that I think that one of the similarities in the treatments is that we're all, both of us, both approaches, are actually very interested in the states of mind that underpin patient behaviors. But that is actually one thing that I think would be very interesting to explicate further, and I hope we can talk more about that, this issue of how we approach this idea of states of mind That there's lots of ways DBT gets at it. It seems very central in a mentalization approach. How we get at it, so that's a commonality. How we approach that is very different, and I might even say in some ways the significance that we attach to certain states of mind and how they unfold are very different. But this idea of states of mind is very important, and what's actually happening in the patient's mind, pausing long enough to draw that out, realizing all the ins and outs and intricacies of that can be very important in DBT approach and I think in the mentalization approach. And again, I think would be one of the things that would help me understand the treatments further, at least mentalization further, is if we kind of compared and contrast the treatments around that term, states of mind.
And I invite others either to add or comment, or if there was another thing that stuck out to you, that's something that was uncovered in this exploration, perhaps expected, perhaps unexpected. Please.
One of the things that I learned as a difference is that MBT works to modulate affect and behavior through enhancing or developing metacognition rather than working directly on changing affect or behavior. And another thing I learned was that I think what MBT considers developing or considering other perspectives is quite compatible with what we would call dialectical thinking.
I guess just to piggyback on, especially the first thing that you said, Jill, I think one thing I was struck by that I didn't expect was that there is this focus on the relationship and what's going on in the room that is really seems to be the primary mechanism of change in MBT, whereas in DBT, there's much more focus on how to solve the problems in their daily life outside of the session. And we were kind of having, some of us were having a discussion during lunch about that and still kind of grappling with it. So in some ways, I feel like there's been some areas where I feel like there's more stark contrast and yet other areas where I'm more confused because because there's a lot of areas of overlap as well, but that's one that does seem to clearly be there in my mind.
Going back to the first comment about states of mind.
Can you pull the microphone over, please?
Back to the first comment about states of mind, one thing that I hadn't anticipated is that a DBT therapy would pay attention
to... I'm sorry, can you hear in the back? Can you
pull it? Shifts?
Just pull it closer in. Thank you.
That a DBT therapy would pay attention to affect shifts in the patient, much the way an MBT therapist would, such as, you know, what happened just then, and noticing it. And that happened repeatedly throughout the day. One thing that I had not understood before was how a DBT treatment could work with the dialectic. And there was an exercise this afternoon where we were all struggling to get a patient to stay with, where she was with her emotions. And when Alan interviewed her, you took a radically different approach, which didn't just go toward the middle, but it went all the way to the other side. And it was a bit jarring for me. And it seemed jarring for the patient, but actually seemed successful in shifting her out of the kind of entrenched position she had been in. It worked.
Would that be an example, do you think, of something that, while perhaps not typical of MBT, is something that I heard some of the DBT people in our last session talk about kind of, ooh, I want to steal that question, I want to steal that kind of thing. Is that something that could be kind of lifted and pulled into MBT, or is that something that was kind of intriguing but separate in terms of from your experience of seeing that sort of radical statement shift?
Well, it, as I was talking about earlier in the opening talk, is that there are these kind of comparable concepts. Whether or not they can be integrated is a different question, but this issue of irreverence versus challenge, which I think function the same way, which is to get someone often stuck or entrenched position, but that the approach is different. Yeah. So, you know, it's tough because I think that in trying to kind of organize ourselves around information, we often like to compare and contrast. But I think the difficulty in my experience today is that sometimes it's neither, you know, similar nor different, but that they, like Alan said, they're different concepts that contain similar phenomenon. And I think clarity about what kind of system you're using to contain the interaction, I think, is quite important. So whether or not the comparisons and the contrast helps us learn, that's one question, but whether or not that's effective in implementation is a different question.
We were talking as we were walking away that we, one thing we saw a similarity, I think, was the attitude towards the patient as seeing them very much as a human being and not a demonstration of pathology, and taking a stance of humility and being comfortable with not knowing, versus some other schools of thought where you're a bit more, I know what's going on with you and I know how you ought to be. And I think that's true of both. I think it's what attracts me to minimalization as well, is that sort of, I don't know. you're the expert on you.
So it sounds like, just hearing some of those last comments, that if I'm hearing it correctly, where there might be a lot of similarity in practice, it might be quite challenging to think of integrating just because of the importance of having a clear theory to guide in that practice. So that's something that I perhaps may be a theme that we can also kind of struggle with, think about, figure out if that is kind of a consensus position, whether there is some direction that it does progress to, starting from that point. In terms of questions, oh, there's some coming up. Oh, excellent. Some questions that came from earlier in the day that didn't get asked directly. One from a session that really talked about the therapist's emotional experience in the room had to do with whether DBT or mentalization would ever use their emotional experience in the session in kind of a direct way. It wasn't very clear in any of the role plays that they were kind of using it. I think there was actually, in some of the role play, there was a reflection of deciding not to use, I think it was Adam, deciding not to use an anger that came up, and this is specifically about anger. So I know this isn't quite on the conclusion, it's more of a kind of a question, but I'm wondering if anyone would respond. Maybe things came up in the sessions that would both address, do you use it, and is that something that's one of those areas that it's in both, or it operates very differently? Would anyone care to speak to? Maybe Adam, who was in that session, were.
Yeah, well, I did learn a bit in that last session that actually it seemed like there was quite a bit of compatibility in the way that both a DBT therapist and an MBT therapist would react to what is happening in the room and actually say, this is how it's making me feel, which I do think is quite a bit different than getting angry as an intervention, which
well,
is not something that we would be going, I think, in either camp.
Yeah, yes.
I guess I'm looking to define what using emotion is, to the extent of making it actually a point of discussion in the session. Absolutely. I think it's, as I understand it, in both camps.
We have a question for the program that combines DBT and MBT, Gunderson, at McLean. How is it combined, Gunderson 3 East? I'm wondering if some from there can say a little bit about what is happening there.
I think Shauna could address this just as well. But I can speak to what happens at the Gunderson Residence, which is a very intensive program, minimum 60 days, lots of different groups. And as we discussed, there's a lot of content and a lot of parsing in DBT of different kind of skills and ideas and ways of thinking about experience. And we take most of the groups doing skills training didactics. But there are two groups during the week that are mentalization-based. One is an IMBT group that Shauna runs, which is very psychoeducational and explicit about talking about what MBT involves, what mentalizing involves. And I'll let Shauna speak to that in a bit. But in the kind of active and what they call implicit mentalizing group, it's really about talking about issues that are coming up in the relationships, much more useful if they're the relationships in the room, because that's kind of an in vivo opportunity to try to keep your capacity to mentalize online when there's an interpersonally intense situation that's unclear. But what's interesting about this is even though it's one group a week, it's incredibly high impact. So it's a group that's the most kind of genuine, interactive, unpredictable of all the groups. And I think that there's a combination of anxiety about the group and a lot of kind of like deepening of understanding and connection about oneself and relationships to others. But Shauna, maybe you could speak to the IMBT.
A little bit about the overlap. So the other group, I think, that we do some mentalization, I'd say focused, is this an interpersonal group that we run. So these folks are in a whole bunch of groups where they're learning skills, and they're also living together. So there's a ton of emotional stuff that comes up between them, some of which they can take and use an interpersonal skill from DBT, like to do a dear man, to practice give, to practice fast. And then there's other times where they hit up against so much emotion that they can't even get themselves to the point of doing a skill. And in that way, I think when we're in the groups where we're doing the mentalization group or the interpersonal group, we're much less likely, or I never actually do say, well, why don't you pull out a dear man and walk through the skill? It's more about trying to move them towards mentalizing each other. So in the introduction mentalization group, what I do often, because it comes right after the interpersonal group where there's a whole lot that's brought up and not much that's metabolized or really even mentalized about, is we then break it down and may spend the entire time on one or two exchanges that happen. So it's much more explicit and structured. Whereas I think Lois's group on Friday is much more traditional in terms of an outpatient mentalization group.
Can I just respond to that? Because I think that description reminds me of one of the biggest distinctions that we came to, which I found was very interesting, is that we had a lot of discussion, I think in both sessions, particularly the afternoon session, that the patients would present something, a problem in life, let's say. And the DBT therapists were generally approaching it, let's say, as per the content. So, okay, you want to pass the bar exam? Let's talk about the bar exam. Okay, you want to go shopping? Let's talk about shopping. You know, like that there was a real content-based kind of one-for-one responsiveness to the patient. And I had this sense of like a little gardening metaphor that like in the MBT approach is more like trying to prepare like a psychic soil that the person could plant productive behaviors in going forward. That if you help them develop this soil, that somehow the things that you're wanting them to do would take root. Whereas, and you correct me because I'm, you know, brand new to this, but that DBT people would be more like, okay, get your shovel, get your hoe, get your seeds, blah, 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 you know, and like basically take them through step by step, let's go plant. And so some people, you know, were saying, well, how about the soil? How about the hoe? How about the shovel? You know, that but I think that's one of the differences is there's a lot of different assuming that's happening in both sides of that metaphor. And, you know, for better and worse, that's one of the distinctions that I was struck by.
On comments, one person observed that to a surprising degree in terms of effectiveness, they thought that a lot more seemed to be dependent upon the perspective flexibility of the therapist, both for moving the interpersonal dialogue and the session and modeling for the patient, and then kind of asked for comments. And I think that, so this person, if I'm understanding this correctly, it was struck that maybe the distinction between the treatments isn't as great as just what a given therapist would do, regardless of the treatment. Would people care to discuss that based on your experience of the day? Greater
therapy. It's good therapy.
I think, if I'm understanding it, that I think in terms of moving the interpersonal dialogue and having an effective therapy, that they were left with, maybe this has more to do with the individual therapist than the whether it's DBT or MBT, and whether people would comment on that, observation from someone.
Sorry, I'm a little plagued by this microphone stand. But as you know, just from speaking from a point of view of someone who's done both, if I may, one of the things I can say is knowing a lot of my colleagues who work with these very appealing and interpersonally challenging patients is that there is a force of personality. Like, I think that all the authors of these treatments have incredible amounts of charisma, and I think that does have an impact on the treatment. And
let's just have a therapy where we teach therapists how to be charismatic. I think
that's right.
Forget it. That's all you have to do.
I think for myself, my own experience of it with my own personality is that different treatments for me help me be myself with different patients. So when I'm using DBT, I think that what's helpful to me about it, it stabilizes me in my work and in my relationships with my colleagues so that I can be available as a human being to my patient, whether I'm using DBT or MBT. And so I think it's something that I use to just enhance my kind of stability and predictability as a person and my attachment to my patient.
I also just had the thought that, you know, in watching all of these role plays this afternoon, there's always a moment in both the DBT and the MBT where the therapist, and I don't know whether this is dependent on their personality or their charisma or what, but where they captivate or they grab the interest of the patient and they get hold of them, and the patient is suddenly engaged. And it has something to do with those moments of making real contact that then there's a collaborative process that ensues and something begins to take off. And perhaps the more that we can look at, you know, what it is that goes into making that contact and those moments where something starts, you know, we'll learn something more.
We had... One observation was that DBT appeared to have more varied practical interventions for engagement, and whether that's actually, certainly DBT has its list of strategies around engagement, but I guess I guess this would go to the MBT side. From the MBT perspective, is that an observation that you would agree with, or is your sense that maybe that's just a function of specifying, but that doesn't necessarily distinguish. It's a little bit different than the theme of the conference being in terms of what you do, what you don't do, but do you see that as something that MBT would potentially have something to borrow from the DBT side around this piece? Or just speak to the issue of engagement from the MBT. The observation from the person was that DBT appeared to have more varied practical ways of getting engagement. And so I guess the question would be whether the experience is that actually maybe they weren't revealed as well, but that there are specific MBT things on engagement, could be a way of looking at it, or, you know, and that the observation, you kind of disagree, you know, they're there. Or whether this is one of these compatible things where actually, yeah, DBT has these kinds of things and those can also be used in MBT. Does that make sense? Does the question make sense? Am I making sense?
Okay. I can speak from having been in that session is, I think, and similar to my experience with the social functioning session, is that there's a lot less kind of skills and, you know, kind of variety of techniques, and there's kind of more of an emphasis on the process of mentalizing, and you know, so it's not got the kind of hard edges that some of the techniques in DBT do do have, like the diary cards, the setting up of the target behaviors and commitment strategies, that is in fact not in MBT. And part of the function of that is that if you give someone a pre-constructed kind of set of tools to think, it may actually work against a kind of spontaneous process of reflection. And so that's kind of the purpose of not actually having all those strategies, because it may undercut the process.
Okay. This observation, both DBT and MBT seem to be targeting deficit more than conflict. Is that impression true? And then related, if so, do MBT and DBT define the deficit in the same way? Would anyone care to comment on that? Did that seem, based on your experience? Please.
Well, we had had an interesting discussion this morning, and I tried to ask that very question of my MBT colleagues when Anthony had mentioned something really highlighting the degree to which the client that he was interviewing had the capacity already, and it felt like what he was trying to do was draw it out of the client. And we talked about that in DBT, we are very dialectical about this very point, that there are ways in which we say, yes, of course you have wise mind, to the client, and we're going to help you find your wise mind. While at the same time, there's no question that DBT is a skills deficit model. We're going to teach you these skills. And so that it seems like while DBT actually looks at it dialectically, my sense was, and you can correct me if I'm wrong, that it is that MBT is less of a skills deficit model. Would you care to?
Yeah, well, it is a deficit model, but the deficit, as you were saying, is not in skills. Again, we've talked about this a number of times. The deficit is in the capacity to mentalize, to understand oneself and to understand one's other people, particularly in an interpersonal context. So we assume there's a deficit, and I would say the focus of MBT is on strengthening this capacity, or reversing, you know, overall reversing this deficit, which that we believe should lead to greater flexibility and ability to regulate emotion, and a reduction of impulsivity. Okay, so. It's a different orientation, different definition as to what the deficit is and what we're focusing on.
Thank you, Daniel. As I'm realizing, as people are speaking, we've been so disjointed with our various sessions. I haven't actually had a chance to speak with each person going around the table, and I'm aware that people in our audience haven't gotten to be introduced to every member. As we go forward, if people could just say who you are and where you're coming from as we go, just to kind of help orient them rather than going around. But that was Daniel Cooper. Daniel Cooper. I understand that.
Cupper.
What's that? Cupper. I'm pronouncing it wrong. Exactly. So my apologies. We haven't met in person. Welcome, Cupper. Excuse me. As I individual identifies the explicit psychoeducation required in DBT and their understanding that. At McLean, that MBT uses psychoeducation groups, but they're unclear whether MBT psychoeducation is kind of required. Is it included in an individual MBT, for example? Could you speak to the role of explicit psychoeducation? Please.
Maybe I better, because this has developed over time for all sorts of different reasons, but originally the... psychoeducation, I can call it that just for ease, actually. That's a complicated topic in its own right, really. But in terms, that was incorporated in the individual sessions at the beginning. So it was very clear after 3, 4, 5 sessions, the first sessions would actually be involved in within the assessment process, the identification of the mentalizing areas that are problematic, the context in which they are, moving towards a formulation, which is then related to the treatment process. So it's fairly specific. okay, people say, you know, about engagement in that sense of trying to engage within the process and the focus and so on. And then that was written down and so on. Now, some of that has been taken out, as it were, and actually formalized within a larger group setting, actually, which is what IMBT was called, MBTI, I don't know what it's called. I'm not sure I care what it's called. Anyway, and that's more formalized in that, and we've been collecting data on that in terms of what it seems to do or not do, both in relation to its own right and also in relation to then ongoing treatment. Okay, so that's really what it is, and it has a particular structure. And we're just going to post the manual on the web at some point in the next few months, so that people can follow it and maybe collect some data. As I said, everything in MBT, sadly for me, is free. So it's you can't even buy it. And the structured clinical management we did for our original research, which was so good, is now, that was free. That's 2,000 copies that sold, as it were.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Over that, actually. but that's the point of it is to try this engagement process and making sure that patients are very clear about the focus of treatment. And so on.
So that requires an educational component to on the front end, getting up to speed, so to speak. Good. Thank you. We have a question that came out of the session on therapist self-care, and it refers to seeing both the DBT therapists and the MBT therapists in a situation where a patient became somewhat emotionally dysregulated kind of accusing the therapist of not caring. They observed that both DBT and MBT got involved with kind of the struggle over whether there was caring or there wasn't caring, and that neither of the therapies in that instance went directly after the fact that there was emotion dysregulation in the room. And they ask about would that occur? Would there be a direct intervention in the DBT or the MBT on the fact, not the content, whether the therapist cares or not, but the fact that the patient was getting emotionally dysregulated in the room. That's the way. Would anyone comment on that? Would that be a part of DBT? Would that be a part of MBT? Maybe Sarah or someone who is or Shauna who is in that session might comment if that question makes sense.
Yes. I think it wasn't so much commented on in the role play that I was doing, and that what was seeming to get in the way of the mentalization at that point was the interaction, and less about the emotion. In an earlier role play, earlier in the day, there was another patient that was played really well, where the woman is just stuck in hopelessness, and at that point, both the DBT therapist and the MBT therapist identified very specifically what is happening in this moment for you, and can you describe what your experience is. But absolutely, it would have fit within the afternoon role plays also, from my perspective.
Sure. I think that one answer we might say in DBT is it depends. Because in some situations, I could imagine the therapist having the hypothesis that these statements of you don't care, actually serve an escape function, in which case we'd actually block it and not pay attention to the content and try to regulate and bring back to what the trigger was for the escape and help regulate. But in another situation where the you don't care actually could be part of the chain. The hypothesis on the part of the therapist is that the dysregulation is in part caused by the experience of, gee, you don't care, then actually that would be a synthesis of interventions to pay attention to the content would be to regulate the patient. So it depends on the hypothesis of the therapist on what the dysregulation was resulting from. Would you all agree with that?
Yes, and as the therapist in the... who was there, first
oh,
of
sorry.
All. Well, you helped frame it for me. I mean, but this is the way the co-leaders work together, is my co-leader just framed it for me. And I certainly agree with the writer that there was emotion dysregulation in the room. And by the way, I'm Adam Payne, just to do what you were saying, from the Center for Cognitive and Dialectical Behavior Therapy on Long Island. And so It felt to me that to attend to the emotion dysregulation in the room at that moment would have been invalidating, and that to attend to the content of the complaint was actually validating in that moment. However, look at the nice dialectic, because if I had the hypothesis that somehow this was actually avoiding something, then I would block it and I would not attend to it in the same way that I did. My sense was that this was a complaint that, at least in the stage that we were at, I needed to take as at its face validity.
It might be going to this theme, which is perhaps emerging, of where while the interventions, the way people are responding in the moment, can look very much the same, the importance of these theories to guide us, these models to guide us, and how important it is to be able to think clearly about what am I understanding to be happening and where do I go based on that. We have a question about self-harm and noticing in DBT that if there's a self-harm, it's always addressed in session. There's a behavioral analysis. Is there a parallel technique or practical intervention when a person engages in self-harm behaviors in MBT? Would anyone on our MBT comment on that? I know this was addressed within a session, and hopefully people that were into that particular session would have had that sort of answer. Maybe people who participated in that session, could you comment on is there a parallel or is that a distinction with regard to responding to incidents of self-harm?
Well, just in that session, yeah, we tried to illustrate that there was an MBT method, which actually turned out not to be so dissimilar, I think, in terms of what we were trying to do. I think and how we were doing things, I think the aim of it was different, and that's something we could end up discussing a little bit. And I think the mindset of the therapist was a bit different. That's what came across to me in that session. But yes, clearly, if somebody's self-harmed, I think that patient was self-harmed and made a suicide or felt suicidal. Mm. And they both have to be addressed, in the session. Just to say that what came across to me in my notes about that was the difference. One of the differences was our stance that we were thinking about it from, of which ours was more interpersonal fundamentally, and along with the affect within that interpersonal, I think. And it was a bit more slanted that way than the DBT particular stance in it, in that particular example.
So a definite way of addressing, clearly articulated, some differences in that particular approach based on those characterizations, those aspects. We have a question about the use of mentalization and DBT for couples. The person notes Alan's work applying DBT to couples. Is there comparable applications of MBT for couples occurring?
Yeah. There's a whole trial on couples, and also there's manualized for family as well, but in a brief intervention, which has actually quite a lot of cohort data, is now part of a trial as well, a randomized trial, in fact, for family work with adolescents, in fact, children mostly. So, yeah, is the answer.
Can I ask a question to piggyback? Are you teaching the adolescents to mentalize, or the parents, or both?
You don't try and teach adolescents anything most of the time. It's kind of not worth it. There's a dialectic for you. Just
I have four children.
Yeah, exactly. So you should know better, Alan. Yeah, but no. It is actually mostly to do with the non-mentalizing of the parents in relation to the adolescents. Okay. But it's operationalized, sure, in what you do.
We have another question. It's really directed toward the MBT, and it's the MBT response of kind of, I don't know, seemed to be a common response, this kind of the uncertainty. And the person observed feeling a little dissatisfied as a client, wanting answers, as a therapist, wanting to be able to give direction without imposing, but to give direction. And from the MBT side, can there be some comment on how to deal with such issues, either as therapist wanting to be able to give an answer or patient wanting an answer, if that makes sense. And I don't know if that doesn't happen on the DBT side as well, by the way. So if I'm on the DBT side, although there certainly is a lot of answers, there's also, I would like to think, a lot of, and I think our DBT people in sessions identified actually resonating with the MBTers with a lot of welcoming uncertainty. So I'm wondering if any of our experts would wish to comment on how to address that when it's explicitly kind of comes up as either a complaint from the patient or a therapist wishing to be more directive, but doing it within the frame of the therapies. Anyone who I see lots of head nods, anyone jump in, please.
Well, we have the dialectic in DBT between omnipotence and impotence.
Can you say a little more there?
Yeah. But I'm absolutely, absolutely sure that I don't know.
Satisfied?
I'm setting it up for someone wiser than I am.
I wasn't going to go there, so I'm not going to get set up with that. But, no, I would say that, I think that maybe a way to answer it is that DBT may say, I don't know, less. I mean, it may, because it is more based in this idea of education, psychoeducation, direction, guidance, teaching. So I think that I'm probably going to be thinking, I don't know, less, perhaps, than that might be used as a strategy. I think there is a great role for it, though. I think certainly welcoming uncertainty and putting the patient in the driver's seat and doing exposure. You know, there certainly be moments when that would come up to me, but it probably wouldn't be the same thing as what you would offer.
Well, we do say I don't know a lot.
We don't.
That's right, because we don't know, and we never want to assume that we really know what's going on in the patient's mind, that it's got to come from them. We don't. Minds are opaque, and so we don't know what is in the other person's mind, and to assume that we do would be omnipotent, I guess. We also, want to, when we don't know, yes, it can be frustrating to a patient, but I think you monitor that in working with the patient in terms of how you say it and how forcefully you say it. But the intent is to get them again to collaborate with you. So even though you're saying, I don't know, you're inviting them to join you in thinking about an event or their experience or whatever they need to do in the outside world. But so it's also an invitation to collaborate in getting a reflective process going.
Can I just say one more thing about it? Because we don't just sit there and say, I don't know, I don't know, I don't know. I don't know. Yeah. That's not what we're talking about here.
No.
We're talking about when the patient is pushing you to give a solution.
Yeah.
And
right.
Actually, at that particular point, you back off from it because usually that solution will be futile unless it's actually worked with the patient in some way. So you will say at that point, look, I don't know. So that's what we're here to try and work out. And you then collaborate, as Robin has said. Mm-hmm. But there may be some times, just to make this clear, that one part of the model, which is fairly well defined, is that the state of mind of the therapist is distinctly important. If the patient says, well, what do you think I should do? And in your mind, it's very obvious what they should do. It's kind of obvious. Then you say, well, I'm just surprised you're asking me that. To me, I mean, if I was in that situation, then you say it. Now, that's not to say that's what they should do, and I'd pick that out pretty quick. But so where's the doubt here, I'd say? What's the problem? Do you see what I mean? That you're making me say what's obvious. Do you see? So then you're shifting around then the mind states, that they're forcing you to give the solution they can already see or did know but can't do, whatever way it is. But you might give that answer if it's very obvious. No problem. It's just stating your particular mindset at that moment. But you're not going to enforce it on the patient.
And we would never say, I don't know, if we know something. I mean, it's a genuine state of, I don't know. If we do know, we might say, just as Anthony has said, well, I'm not quite sure why you're asking that right now, because I would think such and such. But we're not going to say, I don't know, if we know.
And I think that's an incredibly important similarity of genuineness. And we've done some coding from other perspectives where that's not true. from some other therapeutic perspectives, people will say things like, I don't know, when they damn well know. And that lack of genuineness is, from a DBT perspective, problematic. And that's something that's actually quite in common, and it comes back to what Liz brought up in terms of a fundamental respect for the person to actually be honest and sincere and genuine in the moment, which I think is an extremely important similarity.
There's a comment that came, or at least it's was addressed, I believe, in hopefully in the session on improved functioning, and I don't know if this person was present for that one or not, but the observation was that patients may leave therapy before they're able to have things addressed related to their life functioning, and I believe this is would be kind of like within given sessions that you may not get to it. And the question is about to comment on the introduction or attention to these sorts of issues. How do you time addressing issues of functioning so that they don't get lost? How do you include them, or what guidance to address actually functioning in the world within sessions? Does that make sense?
Yeah.
Can anyone comment on that?
I believe this is about within sessions.
How do you?
Actually, it's over the course of time.
Over the course of time.
So,
thank you.
Level one behaviors are addressed. Patient gets frustrated. Life isn't magically better. They haven't really gotten to the quality of life, eating disorder, post-traumatic stress disorder, but they're fed up with
ADHD. How do you? Let's. Thank you. How do you work the timing of when to get to life issues or life problems such as that? Thank you.
Well, I'm Jill Rathis, by the way, from Long Island University and Cognitive Behavioral Associates on Long Island. I think a couple of things. One, I guess in any therapy, and especially with this population, it's possible to have dropout, and then there are high rates of dropout before completion, so you're hoping to engage them in the relationship. And DBT, the second highest priority is therapy interfering behavior, so there's a lot of attention to anything that the therapist or the patient is doing that interferes with completing therapy or participating in therapy to try to prevent dropout before goals are reached. And also, I would say that in every session, there's not only behavioral analysis, but you try to leave time for at least some problem-solving solution analysis so that there is an emphasis on improving functioning in every single session before the patient leaves. There's some goal and some commitment to trying something new, trying something that will improve functioning right away. And even if you're focusing on suicidal or life-threatening self-injurious behavior, as you're using strategies to work on more skillful ways of addressing those behaviors and minimizing those behaviors, a lot of what one is learning will generalize to other issues, other problems in their life. And other things like disordered eating and disordered relationships will come up on the chain as you're talking. They may be important links on the chain, so you may be addressing them early on as an important antecedent to self-injurious behavior.
So there was a lot of detail there in terms of how to include and how the quality of life, the life functioning issues the patients may have come into the therapy along the way, even early in the treatment. I'm wondering if they were on the MBT side. Has any comment of within MBT, is there anything comparable to that on addressing various life issues that the patient struggles with, relative to other kind of issues of engagement and safety? I'm guessing the language would be different, but I'm wondering whether the general strategy of approach, is that something that sounds fairly comparable in some way? Or?
Well, one of the differences is that we don't have what I understand is a fairly, fairly strict hierarchy of things that are targets that are attended to. So that I'm not sure that it's a question that I can quite answer as a differentiating question. I think we all probably get around to the same thing. But the functioning is very much a part of the patient's presentation. You know, it's from the beginning, we're assuming they're not functioning very well in various spheres. We have to be more specific about what areas, what domains they are particularly vulnerable in, or what domains that they become overwhelmed and are dysregulated. But, you know, I'm not sure that we do it in a hierarchical way so that we sort of begin to focus at the very beginning on functioning. I think from the very beginning, that's certainly, as it comes up in the material in the individual session and certainly in the group, this is talked about from the beginning and understood without addressing specific skills.
Thank you. Thank you. Can I ask, we're nearing the end, and I was wondering if Anthony and Alan would be willing to share any preliminary what to make of this from this day. We'll have more time tomorrow after we have a chance to sleep on it, have more conversations, and we'll have more happening tomorrow. But from today, any take-homes or thoughts that you're having or would like to share with our group? Perhaps Anthony?
Well, I'll just say a few things they're things that we discussed a little bit in some of the earlier sessions, but they were really interesting to me. In one session, I think, though, the minds of the therapist, the position, you know, the what they're working on in their own minds about where they're going to focus probably differs, and therefore the sort of we're less concerned about content, is my hunch, in one aspect versus process, and we're probably more engaged a little bit in maintaining a process and not worrying too much about that content, and that may be an emphasis point that may be worth exploring a little bit. I think we were also concerned a little bit more about the detail of the interpersonal, and I took up in the self-destructive thing the sort of non-contingent response, which I thought was the core, which is the very early bit before the patient had gone down this cycle then to burn themselves and so on. And I think you to some extent went a little bit more for the emotional sort of struggle of guilt and the sort of discontrol that went afterwards. So I think there might have been a kind of perspective difference, which meant the focus was slightly different, you know, but I'm not saying that the outcome is any different particularly, but I think that may have been there. And so I think that's around. I think there is something perhaps to do with knowing and not knowing and how much we might do that and to what extent. I think there is potentially more delivery of solution from DBT than we would deliver, probably. And that's what I've observed before, you know, that there are things that you have a little bit, in a way, you do some of the process, though. So it's not just you're telling them to do something. You know, I just think that's bad therapy of any kind. So I don't think that. But I think there might be a difference between that. And also to just remind people, you know, that we're very focused from MBT perspective on that sort of intrapsychic, which I think Lois put up right at the beginning, and then moving that as much as possible to the actual interpersonal and the current, and maybe how we use that interpersonal as the focus might be more concentrated than in DBT as an actual explicit focus that tells me and you about what you're doing out there with everybody else, and that's where the interpersonal goes wrong. And we do that in the group as well, and so the group becomes the, if you like, the mentalizing arena of the interpersonal, where we can see it so goes wrong, and then you discuss that further in your individual, because the individual and the group therapist work jointly. So if it's all gone haywire in the group, then the individual therapist say, hi, you know, I hear it all went wrong, you know, what was going on here? So you can then observe yourself, as it were, in the group about what your interpersonal problem was and what your sensitivity was. So there's a big focus on that, I think, and it may be much greater, more explicitly so, openly so, perhaps even.
Thank you. And Alan, please.
I those things make sense. I think that in my observations today, anyway, and in discussions here in the panel, there's some interesting nuanced differences, I think. For example, it's pretty clear that MBT people are interested in affect states and affect regulation, but not necessarily as a core process. And, of course, that's a core process in DBT. And I think that people in DBT are pretty interested in what you call mentalizing, both in terms of what we would call mindful self-awareness and relational mindfulness, awareness of the other person's processes, emotional and cognitive processes, specifically vis-a-vis the patient. So there's an interest in that, but not necessarily as heightened. I think that the dialectic around content and process is more of the DBT perspective. We would see, in general, I think, a content focus in the moment as a vehicle for getting at process, and at other times focusing on the process directly, go back and forth. They're the same thing, literally. There's truth in the opposites in a DBT perspective. And I guess that's one thing that's emerged. I'm not sure it's right, but at least the hypothesis I'm leaving with today that I'm interested to discuss more tomorrow is that one of the things, if we think about the different components of how we structure DBT, the dialectic is constantly present. So we think about stylistic processes. There's a dialectic. We're extremely warm. We're extremely irreverent and kind of flip back and forth between those relatively seamlessly at times. Some of that's therapist difference in the way that we do it, but that's still a hallmark of the treatment. And I'm not sure that there's a premium in MBT per se for being dialectical in that way. I'm not sure that's a goal per se. It's not that you couldn't do it. It's just not a goal. Same thing when we talked about interfacing with a system of care. In DBT, there's a dialectic, consultation to the patient whenever that's possible, empowering the patient whenever that's possible, and intervening on their behalf under certain circumstances that we define. And I think that in many situations, MBT and DBT people would do the same things, but in certain situations, the dialectic leads to some differences in that way. So stylistically, interfacing with systems of care, and so forth. And then even this question about not getting to quality of life, I think in DBT we see emotion dysregulation as this core problem. So if we're solving the problem of not being lonely today, we see that the core, one of the core, maybe not the only or the core, but one of the core issues is how to manage emotion to solve that problem. And we assume that if we can solve that piece, that that's going to make the problems of getting a job and having close relationships that are meaningful and intimate in your life a lot easier in 6 months. And so they're overlaid in a dialectical fashion. So those are my thoughts for the day.
Thank you, Alan. This day that we just had, actually was Alan Frazetti's brainchild some 5 years ago, and I sort of overheard a conversation and thought, what a wonderful, wonderful idea. So this has actually literally been kind of years in the making to bring experts together to flesh out these ideas, really understand what happens in the room, and to stop and to really get away from, while the theory conversations are crucial and to guide us, but to actually get to spend time with the nuts and bolts of what happens in the therapy. So I really hope that you all enjoyed as much as I did getting to be in the room, getting to see this in action, up close, compare and contrast. Tomorrow, I believe most of you, I hope all of you, will come and join us again. We have several additional presentations. To some extent, we're going backward. Now that you've kind of seen the experts do the therapy, we're going to have Anthony and Alan each spell out for you their therapy and give you more of a proper introduction to the theory and why they did what they did. So we're all going to sleep on this and kind of learn from the day. As you're doing that tonight, if you realize you have questions, hopefully we'll be able to answer many of those in those sessions. We'll get to see Anthony and Alan in action in role play. And then we'll have perhaps more consolidated conclusions for practice and for research in terms of how might this conference's contribution go forward, what to do with it. So I want to extend a very heartfelt thank you to our panelists, our experts. This was Alan originally described this as a working conference, and I believe that you all really worked very hard today. I so appreciate it. So I wish everyone a good evening. Please make sure to turn in your forms for your continuing education, and please hand in an evaluation on your way out. And I look forward to seeing you tomorrow. Thank you very much.